Conversations with Lisa Forrest on ABC Local Radio.
Very good morning to you wherever you're listening to Conversations. It's my pleasure to be here sitting in the chair for Richard Feidler for today and tomorrow. And I have to say, it's a pleasure to be working on a show that I get so much enjoyment from as a listener. So thanks for your company today. I hope that you have settled down somewhere comfortable for our chat this morning. I'm warning you that there is little chance of me being an objective interviewer today because I'm such a fan of our guest. I know that I'm not the only parent listening who has read a chapter of one of her fabulous books to their child before bed, dutifully kissed that child goodnight despite the protests and the wails of, please, one more chapter, and then slipped downstairs, book under arm, to read on alone because the story is just too good to put down. I'm talking, of course, about the storytelling of Emily Rodda, a true superstar in children's book publishing in Australia. Since her first book was published in 1984, Emily Rodda has been prolific, really, the author of some 50 works of fiction. She's sold around 15 million copies worldwide, the most successful of those being the absolutely wonderful Del Toro Quest series. And she has won countless awards for her books, including the prestigious Children's Book Council of Australia's Book of the Year Young Readers Award, a record 5 times. But the road to superstardom, as an author at least, had its ups and downs. In a way, I'm interviewing two people today because before she unleashed her alter ego and allowed Emily Rodda to truly roam free, Jennifer Rowe had convinced herself that writing was something she really wasn't very good at. Jennifer Rowe, welcome to the show today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's lovely to have you with us. We'll get into that decision that writing was something that you just didn't think you were any good at because in the lead up to that, writing had actually, first of all, got you into trouble at school. I believe that you could write before you went to school, but your teacher went crook on you.
Yes, that's right. It was my first year of school, you know, the kindergarten year, and I'd never been to preschool. And so I went in with just the stuff that I'd been doing at home. And we hadn't done much painting at home. Well, we'd done a little bit of colouring in, things like that. Not a lot of painting. Of course, I had taught myself to read and write. So I'd never had an experience with that great big butcher's paper that, you know, preschool kids know how to, and the big pots of paint or anything like that. And confronted with one of these big things, I didn't know what to do with it. So
that's not the lovely page I've been writing on home, right?
I drew this kind of little drawing of my mother ironing with a cat beside her, which was particularly peculiar because we didn't even have a cat. I was obviously very fazed by this. But what I could do was write, you see. So I wrote a big caption, Mother Ironing with Our Cat, in very big letters. Anyway, the teacher saw this and, oh, it was terrible. She said, well, this is not at all creative because you haven't filled the page. You've got to fill the page. And we're not up to writing. You shouldn't have done that. And what you've written, what a joke. It sounds as if your mother is ironing with the cat. And everybody laughed. So I learned some valuable lessons from that. One was keep a very low profile at school.
Yes.
The second one was I was not creative. And the third one was you should never volunteer to do anything
that puts you ahead of the class or in different
positions.
Yes,
that you haven't been told to do. The result of that, of course, was that then when I got up in years, I was reading secretly at home, you know, Pookie the Rabbit with Wings or Marmaduke the Possum, and at school was studying Happy Holidays with Jane and Bob. Now, it's interesting because exactly the same thing happened to my daughter many years later.
Tell me about that.
Well, I went to her school, you know, for the parent-teacher thing.
Yeah.
And the teacher, it was her very first year, the teacher was showing me the little books that they were reading. And I said, you do know Kate can read. She said, oh, no.
So Kate
learned the lesson before I did, obviously.
So yeah. she had not volunteered?
She hadn't volunteered that she could read any better than
the level
she was supposed to, inverted commas, read.
Because
some kids are just like that, aren't they? They pick it up. It's like some kids have a very good idea of numbers or shapes or what fits into what, or they're very good with their hands. It's a kind of talent, really, that just some kids have. Other kids go to reading and writing differently.
And you can be very strong in one area and then, of course, not be as developed
very
in the other.
So it's others.
So when you said that you could read and write before going to school, had that come from your mother and father?
I had books that I loved. I mean, the saggy baggy elephant springs to mind. You know, those little golden books.
Yes, yes.
I had books I loved, and of course they were terrific in reading to me. So they had read it to me so many times that quite young, very young, I memorised them. A lot of kids do.
Yes.
So I could pretend to read too. In fact, my great aunts used to say to my mother, "She'll strain her little brain." They warned her, you know. Careful.
She was coming at you from all angles, wasn't it?
So, but I did actually, after a while, pick up the fact that some words meant these sounds and so on and so forth, and then started copying out the books to make my own books with the words that I'd picked out. So I literally taught myself. A lot of children will do this. But as I say, it's a talent, like being able to climb or...
So how old were you when you were writing your first little books, before you went to school?
Oh, when I was four, I was doing that. Just little, very scrappy little books, probably great big straggly letters and so on and so forth. But still, it was something that I was drawn to from the start. And, in fact, it's interesting. I sort of think reading and writing always went together for me. There was always... One was always an extension of the other.
That because you read, you came up with your own ideas of a story that you would like to
tell? Yeah, it just didn't occur to me that this wasn't the best way to go. You know, you like reading stories, you like the stories people told. I love the stories in the radio serials, any stories, anyone. And so having, as I felt, mastered letters, the natural thing was to... be writing as well.
And so you used to write plays then for your brothers to be take
part
in?
That was when I was older, yes. My poor brothers.
And I mean older, like 8 or, you know, 14?
I mean, we're probably 10 or so, yes.
Like Brownie in Atonement.
Yes, my brother was always, especially the one 3 years younger than me, was always roped in and was very obliging.
Good on him. So what... So when you were reading, were you reading as well then beyond what other children would be reading? I mean, were you suddenly reading, Black Beauty when you were 6 or, you know, that sort of thing?
I was reading, yes.
Well above.
But in fact, I have to say that by the time I was in, I suppose year 3, it would be now, I had friends who were also reading. We used to all read quite a lot. And we used to swap what we read. So we were all reading at that age, at year 3. Well, we were all reading Enid Blyton then.
Of course.
Because she was the great star and she was prolific. She was wonderful. Because what you need at that age is plenty of fodder, you know, to get your practice up. And I don't suppose everybody was as mad on reading as we were, but I had a whole group of friends who loved it.
So the kindy teacher had not been successful in convincing you that you weren't creative.
Not as far as painting is concerned. And to this day, I cannot draw. I'm sure it's her fault.
I will blame her. But you're not illustrating your 50 books as well.
That's right. Yeah.
So when did you decide yourself, though, that you weren't creative enough to... Right.
Oh, well, it just came out of my love of reading, really. Because
No, but you weren't. You decided then that you wouldn't write as a teenager.
Yes, but that's what I mean.
Okay.
You see, what happened was that when I got to the end of all the children's books I could lay my hands on, I'd done all the Anne of Green Gables and the Snuggle Pots and all those things, we all actually just swung effortlessly into adult books. So by the time we were about 11, we were reading Wuthering Heights and things like that, because that was the way people...
What was next?
...was done. And I read my way through all my parents' bookshelves. And, of course, I have to say, no one stopped me from reading anything. I just read everything I could and nobody thought a book was going to harm me as long as I read plenty. So I read lots of library books and so on and so forth. And then I suppose I got to about 16 and I thought, by that time I'd read Jane Austen and I'd read a lot of people I thought were wonderful. And I suddenly thought, this is like my brother thinking he's going to be an astronaut, me thinking I could be a writer. These people are geniuses, and I'm clearly not. And I thought it was, well, you know, when you're 16, you know everything. I thought it was a realistic, disappointing, but realistic approach. And I literally then didn't put pen to paper at all, except to write university essays and things like that.
And was that also, certainly when, you know, by the time you're 16 and you're studying a lot of literature at school and you're breaking down the texts and you're, you know, being told what is an image and what isn't and you know, what the themes are, and you're starting to be completely bamboozled by it, and you're writing essays, and I suppose other people are writing essays in class, so you know who's really good at it. Mm. Was it related to that as well, that it was almost the breaking down of the books or...?
No, I don't think in my case it was. Mm. I think it was that I genuinely had such huge respect for these people who produced these things that gave me such enormous pleasure and taught me so much. Mm. I think I just thought, yeah, I thought my talent was a precocious and minor talent. I just had made up my mind that that's what it was, and it would be foolish to keep going. Now, these days I say to children, you know, if I have the opportunity, never give up like that. That's such a silly thing to do. If you can't be the absolute best, does it matter? What matters if you love it? And I quote to them that Chinese proverb that goes something like, if only the birds sang who sang the sweetest, how silent the forest would be. Because I really feel that. Minor talent or great talent, we've all got something to offer, even if it's just to our own family and friends. So it was a very arrogant thing to do, really, just to give it up.
You're listening to Conversations on ABC Local Radio, and my guest is children's author Emily Rodder, although at this point in your life when we're talking about, you are not yet Emily Rodder. No. Your grandmother is, in fact.
Yeah, my grandmother is.
You are Jennifer Rowe, who's decided you can't write, and who not as well as the people that you love. Mm. And, I mean, in terms of that, there is, I would say, even more pressure now, I imagine, for children, I think, to be the best at something. Is that a more difficult thing to convince them of now?
I think it's a great shame. Yes, I think we're good at picking talent in people. Mm. You know, you can, you know, somebody's a great swimmer. As a child, you try and give them every help. Someone shows an aptitude for music, they get lessons. You know, they get whatever their parents and their schools and their advisors can supply. But the children whose talent is not so great, perhaps, or who get to a certain point and then, well, maybe they're not going to get to the Olympics. It's as though they feel they've failed, when in fact they haven't failed. They've been really good at what they've done and will continue to be good at it and will continue to get enormous pleasure out of it if they keep doing it. But I think it's quite sad when you see a child, you know, feeling that because their talent may not be what's going to put them on the world stage, they shouldn't bother with it.
And by that point, they've probably lost the pleasure, as you say, of what they were trying to do.
Yeah, they can do. So I really try to advise, just do it for yourself. I say to parents, your child's writing great stories, terrific. Don't make them enter every competition. Don't send the work to a publisher and say, this is what my wonderful child has done. You'll almost certainly be rejected. Not always, but almost certainly. And then what does the child feel? The child thinks, oh, I'm no good. But that's not true. For the 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 14-year-old, they're doing fabulously well.
Mm-hmm. And did you voice these sorts of fears or this belief suddenly that you had to anyone, or was it something you decided?
I didn't say a single word to a soul. No. I just decided it in my own mind. Mm. And no doubt people thought that I was just busy, which I was. You know, I went to university and had a lot
literature.
Of work to do. I did English literature,
so
yes.
You didn't leave it alone. You never left it alone.
Well, the point is I dropped the writing part, but the reading part, no, it was my life. It would never stop. So I went on doing that and did all those things and then went to work for a publishing company because I was close to books there. You know, I thought of being a journalist.
I was going to ask you about this. Yes,
yeah, it crossed my mind that possibly I could write nonfiction. You see, and so I thought maybe I could do that. My parents weren't keen on journalists. My father worked in television, having come out of newspapers. He was the general manager of Channel 7 and later head of the 7 network for quite a long long time. And I think he thought journalism was pretty tough for a woman. It was too in those days, a bit hard to get above the gossip columns. You know, people did it, of course, but
society pages. And...
Yeah.
yes.
anyway, so, but so it was he suggested to me publishing.
So nonfiction was something you thought you might be able to write, but not the fiction.
Yeah. I couldn't see how people could think of these stories, the ones I loved so much, because I always loved a really good plot, you know. I wasn't a huge admirer of slice of life sort of fiction. I loved things with stories, whether they be children's books or adult books. Mm. So that's one of the reasons why the 19th century novels are still my, you know, great favourite. And modern ones like Possession, for example.
Yes.
The A.S. Byers books. See, I love those sort of things that have got a real plot.
Yes. So you went into publishing.
So I went into publishing and I worked in publishing. Well, subsequently, I ended up, that was my career for many, many years.
Was there frustration or pain reading some of those manuscripts that once you had decided that you weren't going to write, as you read some of the manuscripts that came in, did it ever occur to you that, well, people are writing and they're not as good as Jane Austen, you know? What am I saying to myself?
You know, I think it actually didn't occur to me in quite that way. Until I regained my confidence after what I think was probably just a very, very long adolescence. I think probably having my own children made me a more confident person. Mm-hmm. And yes, I would see these things coming in and I would sort of think, well, these aren't so kind of wonderful, really. Mm-hmm. Some of them, of course, were.
Of course.
And then I started telling my own daughter, when she was 7, stories. I was still working in the publishing company then. She'd asked me to tell her stories because I think she was reading for herself. Anyway, so I started telling her stories and one day I just thought to myself, well, you know, that's not a bad story really. And I wrote it down.
Mm.
And I showed it to Kate and she liked it. So I submitted it to a publisher under a false name.
Yes, which is how Emily wrote her book. But you submitted it to your own publisher
under
a false name.
I did.
So they sent the manuscript off.
Yes. I don't know. I think it must be, you can tell by the way I write that I'm devious, obviously. I just liked the idea of the people I trusted reading it, but I didn't want them to know it was me because then they might give a distorted view, you know.
Mm. Oh, yes. You must have an absolutely professional view that you are as good as Jane Austen, not the...
Anyway, so it went through the various processes and...
So at what point did you have to reveal yourself, though?
How did that happen? Literally when it had been to a couple, the reader, and, you know, who'd given it worth a second read, you know. It went to a few senior editors who recommended it. I then thought, this is a bit of a problem now. I can't actually take it out of the system. I sent it to the publisher, Richard Walsh it was, at Angus and Robertson, and he said, he came in and he said, well, it's short, so I don't know how you'll package it, but I think the woman can write. There's no doubt about that. You better ring her up and find out how old she is, see how many more books she's got in her. So then I laughed and I said, oh, it's me. And he was so surprised.
Was he?
Yes, he was. His jaw went, ah! Yeah, anyway. So he said, well, what fun, we'll do it. You know, we still won't tell anyone, you know, because obviously the book might get special treatment and I wouldn't like that. Being published by your own company is a little bit...
Mm.
If I had my time all over again, I probably wouldn't have submitted it like that. It's just, I suppose I was playing around at the time. You know, but anyway.
How was that moment, though, when he said, well, the woman can write?
Oh, I was very pleased. Very pleased and amused. Yeah.
I'm sure.
Anyway, that was my first one.
And that's something special?
That's something special and that's still in print now.
Mm-hmm.
And but it won the Children's Book of the Year Award the following year, so I was very lucky there. And I think that gave me the encouragement to feel maybe I could, but I didn't know where the idea had come from or why I'd managed to do it. And then I thought of an idea for a second book, and so I wrote that. And then that won a Children's Book of the Year.
I know, it's fantastic. It's great work. It's coming up to 26 past 11, and you're on ABC Local Radio. Lisa Forrest is with you, hosting Conversations. And my guest is children's author Emily Rodder, who has finally revealed herself to her publisher as the first, as Jennifer Rowe, and working for them. And just in that, we are about to go to the headlines, but... every 2 years you wrote one of these award-winning books, but how did you then, you were still working full-time at that point.
Yeah.
So how did you write, or when did you write?
I used to give myself 3 nights a week. After the kids were in bed and, you know, settled, then I would, on these 3 nights, write. It was so wonderful. It was like some people look forward to, I don't know, a long hot bath or going to the gym maybe. People say, how did you find the time and so on? But it was such a refreshment to me, such an enormous pleasure. I used to, you know, think, oh, you know, tonight's my night, my writing night. Mm. I'd be very happy. I only got a few hours, of course. Mm.
And the household knew that? Your husband knew that? Everybody sort of knew?
Everybody
that
knew, yeah.
This is mum's time.
Mum's night.
We're going to
bed
early.
I don't think the kids care much.
No.
Probably my daughter did.
By this time, how many children did you have then?
Four.
Oh, so all four were born.
Yes.
And so your boys must have been little?
Yes, they were very little, yes. They were, they were born in 1986.
Oh, okay. So the first one was out by 84.
Yes.
86, you've got brand new twins. And 3 nights a week, you're thinking, thank goodness, I can get away from you all and write my stories.
Well, I'd put them to bed first.
Yes,
I've never tried to write when the children were awake. It never worked.
Mm-hmm. But
just frustration is caused by it. But, they'd go to bed and then it was my time.
And at that particular time then, since your daughter was your eldest, were you writing for her?
I was, I think, in the first couple of books, yes. The first three probably. But then as my son, second child, Hal, started growing up, I started thinking about him. So Finders Keepers has a boy. It was my first. I think I'd learned more about boys by then, and I wanted to write about boys because I felt they were under pressures and things that girls weren't, and I found it very interesting watching them all grow up, and I knew much more about them. So The Finders Keepers was about a boy, and many of my subsequent books were about boys as well.
And you were still on individual books at this particular time?
Oh, yes.
The Quest series was way off.
It was still way off. That had to wait till I gave up work.
So in terms of the difference then that you were when you were writing about boys and girls, and we're talking about 8-year-olds, or was Hal younger?
I think Hal was about... six when Finders Keepers was being written. And, I think that's about how old he was. So he was the one, he was my first model, but then I had Alex and Clem coming up. And by the time Rowan of Rin was written, they were at school themselves.
So when you were saying that they need different things, boys and girls, what do you mean?
Well, I suppose what I mean is that it seems to be, and this is not every case.
But and this is young boys, then, we're talking about 6, 8,
I'm
at that
talking
particular
about
point.
Primary school boys,
yes.
Yeah, very much, because they were... I feel as though they're so energetic and they're so full of life and they're so full of aggression often. Not all of them.
No.
But a lot of them are. And yet in today's society they have to be so good or people think there's something wrong with them and they keep getting into trouble. And people say, oh, well, maybe he's got attention deficiency syndrome, whatever. Sometimes it's just because boys are just filled with bubble and they're so physical and they don't get to discharge that physical energy. And it seems to they get into trouble. And it seems to me sometimes the pressures on boys to be a masculine version of what we used to think was a girl that is very well-behaved and well-mannered, so that... If they're choosing school leaders in primary school, so often a lot of those will be girls because girls know how to
behave.
and work the system. Mm. We know how to behave. Mm.
We don't have the energy coursing through us. But can
we do have some. Oh, and many girls do. But I think it is a particular problem for little boys. Like, one of my twins was very much like that. The other one was quite quiet. Mm, and it was quite easy for him to be well behaved and keep his hair neat and do all these things. So he was always the one chosen to sort of put the wreath on the cenotaph or something like that, because he was seen as a responsible, mature person. But the other one was just as mature, really. Mm. It's just that he had a different fizz in his blood.
And so can you help them expel that by what they read?
Or, well, it's my belief that you can. And it's part of the problem is that often very energetic little boys, very naughty little boys sometimes, don't read much. Mm. They don't read much because they're impatient with it. They think television and computer games are much more fun. And I used to, you'd see them when you were talking in a class, for example, to a school group, there'd be these little boys down the front, naughty little faces, wriggling under the teacher's eye, you know, drawing often, because they often love drawing. They did not read for pleasure. They read because they had to read. Someone would say to them, go and read your nice book, you know, you know, oh, when I was a child, how I would have loved it if someone had said that. They were always saying, get your nose out of a book.
Yes, yes, yes. So mine too.
Conversations with Lisa Forrest on ABC Local Radio.
And we're speaking to Emily Rodder about her fabulous career as one of our most successful children's book authors. I don't know why we say children's book authors. We should just say one of our most successful authors, although I believe that people do ask you when you'll go back to writing a real book, meaning
sometimes
an adult book.
Many times I've been asked that. When am I going to write a real book again?
Now, we're speaking about your writing, and we're going to get into that because we have to talk about your both Rowan and Del Toro Quest, which, of course, are fabulous, fabulous books. But before you decided to write full-time, you were in publishing and you decided to take a job as the editor of the Woman's Weekly.
Yes, well, I was offered that job. And at that time, I was just about to turn 40, and I thought, well, why not? You know, it seemed like a very, very big change. And after all those years in publishing, which I loved very much, I suppose I felt like a change. That was it. And so I actually did it. I went, and I think the poor women at the Weekly, who were such professionals, I think they thought, who is this person, you know, coming out of this other industry, won't know anything. In fact, it was the best few years, you know, it was the most exciting, great fun. And we actually found we all got on very well together in all their different areas. They were so good at it. And I turned out to actually have something to offer. In fact, a book publisher does have things to offer to a monthly magazine at least.
What sort of things?
Well, I think we understand, well, certainly everyone works very hard. I think possibly in ACP, people thought that people who came out of book publishing basically worked with a quill very leisurely. But it's not, of course, not at all like that. Most people in publishing are terribly overworked and continually have a pile of manuscripts. So we're actually quite used to working fast. Mm. In addition, as a publisher, I was used to putting together as varied a list as possible for each month, so that you knew the value of humour, you knew the value of a bit of practicality, you knew the value of a newsy story. So even though the Weekly was a monthly, we tried to also do that. The features editor, Susan Duncan, was very good at that. Mm-hmm. Other people, the deputy editor, Deb Bailey, was very good at thinking of other sorts of stories which we could put in, which would actually help women, help them a lot. Things like how to examine your own breasts, for example. Mm. Things about what to do if your husband's beating you up. Tucked away there amid all the other things, so that the whole magazine was like a resource. And the fact that I had a family actually helped too, I think, because I think in those years the Weekly had a bit more about kids in it than perhaps it had before. Mm. So I used to think of the whole magazine as being like you were having lunch with a dear group of friends once a month. Mm. And some of those people were outrageous gossips, and some of them were funny, and some of them were great cooks, and some of them could show you little tricks to do with flowers. Mm. To me, that was what it was good at, and it used to go into people's houses and really give them that. And, of course, in those days at least, The Weekly was the biggest read magazine by men as well.
So they never admitted it, I don't suppose.
No, no, they never admitted buying it, but... I think a million men a month was supposed to read The Weekly. It was amazing. And so we used to get quite a bit of correspondence from men as well.
Was it your last fling then at non-fiction as to whether you decided to pursue that you could come up with the stories that would mean you could write full-time and be a fiction writer?
Well, no, I did love my time at The Weekly and the people I worked with. But the time did come when I had at that time about 7 books in print and importantly, publishing overseas. So I felt confident about the income, and I felt it wasn't irresponsible of me to give up my day job, as they say.
So. And at that point, your sons were all getting older. Your twins were getting to an age where...
Yes, the boys were all at school by then.
And 8 or 9, I know you've said before, was that sort of age where we're starting to lose boys.
Yes, that's very true.
To reading, I should say.
To reading, yes. Well, it is. Towards the end of primary school is when, if you're not really careful, boys will actually stop. I think what we ought to remember is when kids are little, we read to them. Mm. And they have not only the stories that are being read, but they have the closeness of the parent and the funny voices and all those good things about reading to a child. But until your child is actually reading alone for fun, you can't be complacent about the fact that they love reading. The great trick is to get them reading alone. And, of course, by the time kids are quite old, you know, sort of the end of primary school and can read, a lot of parents, of course, stop reading to them, and quite right. Mm. You know, then they might occasionally, but they're not doing it as a regular thing every single night. They think, you know, their son or daughter now will
can
be reading read. Alone, can read, will be reading alone. But a lot stop because it actually isn't as much fun to them as watching TV or, importantly, playing a game on the computer or on the TV screen. Mm. And reading has to compete with all those things as well as with their work, all the extracurricular lessons they do and sport and all those other things. Now, you know, that means... there has to be a genuine pleasure there for any child, or else why should they do it for fun? They've got to do it for school. Mm-hmm. But unless it becomes that habit, that thing that it was perhaps to you, it certainly was to me, that companion for life, then they'll never develop the reading stamina that's going to make them go on being readers, which is the point, I think.
So Rowan of Rin, I know, preceded... the Del Toro Quest, and in fact, whetted your appetite for a big Quest series.
Yes.
But I've read that, you know, lots of children say to you that Rowan is a favourite, and it was a favourite of yours to write.
Yes, it was really the first book that I wrote after I left full-time work. And I actually thought it was a bit of a risk, to tell you the truth. Mm. I thought kids would love it, would like it, but I didn't think adults would approve of it, because in those days there wasn't much of that sort of fantasy written for that age group, that is high fantasy, the kind of fantasy where you are in the fantasy world from the start.
Mm.
And it was told in a kind of storytelling way. I thought a lot of teachers and parents wouldn't like it. But I was convinced children were. And it was partly because I'd been watching my own boys playing computer games. And I'd suddenly looked at what they were doing. They were doing quests. I mean, Mario Brothers was a quest, wasn't it?
Yes, of course.
The finding the hidden treasures. They're all quests. They were using all the mechanisms from the old tales, the three wishes, the special object, that you had to find, for example. I thought, these people have stolen some of the best stuff about old stories, and they've put them. And, of course, I could see that the children loved them. I thought... that's where it came from. Mm. I thought, I'll write a quest. A mystery quest.
I think the last time I spoke to you, I was rather rude in that I just read the first Rowan after Del Toro, and I said the first one was kind of simple, which of course was, you know, hardly the thing to say to you. But all I meant was, I think that in the first Rowan, it's, you know, seven hearts the journey makes, seven ways the hearts will break. And I guess per chapter, as Rowan got onto the quest, we lost a person.
That's right. Yeah.
By the second one, it was almost like your warm up to writing that sort of stuff. Is that for you the way that it was? Because by the second one, it was really.
The first one has a kind of purity to it, you might say, and will always be, from that point of view, my personal favourite, although I'm actually like them all.
That's not to say I wasn't in tears by the end when Rowan comes back. Oh my goodness, I could hardly read it, but aloud.
Yes, some of my best letters come from kids who've read it at school, and they say, "And Mr. McIntosh cried at the end." They say in their letters, I really like that. I like to think. I had specifically intended to write a fable when I wrote Rowan of Rin, and I really almost wrote it without stopping. It was just. Practically.
Five books, or you mean the first one?
No, the first one.
Oh, the first one, yes.
But having created the character and the world of Rin, I'd really couldn't, of course, leave it alone. So the more I thought about it, the more complicated, in a way, the stories became. And so the subsequent books don't have that fable-like simplicity.
No, I see.
But they do have adventure, which I enjoyed very much.
And by the end, Rowan has, you know, someone like Zeal. When Zeal arrives and he's on the quest for the Buckshaw, it was almost, I wondered if you'd learnt what Leif would need when he was in his quest, once we get into Del Toro quest, that you do need to have some companions, that you need to have the people you rely on.
I actually had started Del Toro quest before I wrote that Rowan of the Buckshaw, which I'd been sort of saving up. Rowan of the Buckshaw for a long time because I knew that ending right at the very beginning and I didn't ever say it. I think I had got more experienced with handling sets of characters rather than concentrating only on one. Rowan was very much of a loner, of course, and more or less remained so for the first few books.
Yes.
But gradually he also learned to deal with companions and... But when I started writing Del Toro Quest, which was my effort, I really wanted to write a big quest on a big canvas, which meant, having finally got to the big canvas stage, perhaps, and filling up the paper, I decided I would write it over the first series, over eight books, so that I could make the book short enough so that the children in the age group wouldn't feel daunted by them, but that I could tell a quite complicated and long story, which is what I really want to do.
And that was one of the things, because I know I've said this to you before, the thing that I found frustrating, say, about Harry Potter was that those first ones are terrific. Then they get quite big and quite bloated. And as an adult, of course, she wasn't writing for me. You know, you could have had some good editing. But I was amazed with Del Toro Quest as we got into the series. Every book is the same size. And I was amazed that you were able to do that.
Well, I planned it that way. That's what I wanted. I found it is very difficult to write to size when you're writing. Well, I find it so when you're writing a piece of fiction like that. But what I would do was I would write it to however long the story ran, often it would come to 40,000 words, maybe sometimes even 50, and then I would cut it and cut it and cut it. I used to think of it as like polishing a gemstone until it would fit. And of course we did, my husband Bob and my daughter Kate actually set it within our own house, so I was able to make sure every page worked.
What do you mean they set it within your house?
Well, we did. We did the production on it, and we sent the disc to the publisher, because I wanted all those graphics that are in the books, which the brain teasers, the codes, they had to fall in exactly the right place. And the only way that could happen was if we controlled it, because otherwise it would have been too complicated. So we actually produced what those pages look like in our office at home.
Oh, your husband and your daughter by this point was part of it.
Oh, she was, yes. She was well part of it, yes.
Oh, I didn't realise
that. She did the graphics, Kate.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Yeah. So she sort of had moved from having stories told for her to help mum.
Absolutely. She's a huge help to me. And she always reads my books and, you know, gives me good criticism.
But we skipped over the part that you did actually prepare for that series for over 2 years. You
oh,
know,
yes.
You kept putting stories into a box.
I thought about it for a very, very long time. I don't think you can really start a thing like that without a lot of thought. And in fact, the series I've just completed, the Rondo series, mm-hmm. began such a long time ago that I was literally a little girl when I first thought of a world inside a music box. But it took a very large number of years and maturity, I think, and learning things before I felt I was ready to actually write about the world that was inside the music box. So I always say to kids again, you have to know your world if you're going to write fantasy very well as you know your own and know your people, whether you're writing fantasy or not, as well as you know your own family or friends. Get to know them. You mightn't ever use some of the things you know in the actual book, but the fact that you know them will make them seem more real to everybody else.
You're listening to Conversations on ABC Local Radio. My guest is children's author Emily Rodder, and we're talking about her wonderful series Del Toro Quest, which followed Rowan of Rin, which was aimed at boys at that particular age. But I know, well, as we read the series to Dexter, we'd often be at a cafe or something like that and recommend the book, and then someone would say to me, oh, but is it a boys' book? And I said, well, Jasmine's a fabulous girl character. Oh. She's as tough as anyone in that book, and she speaks to the trees, of course.
Oh, absolutely. I think it would be equal boys and girls, you know, who like Del Toro. I think the point is boys do like it. I think it's very... I'm now getting as many letters from boys as from girls, or maybe even more about Del Toro Quest. They both like it. That's the point. That's the thing that pleases me so much. Mm. And now when I go to schools and do a school talk, those little boys, those very same ones with the naughty little faces who were wriggling, have got these Del Toro Quest books in their hands, thumbing through, you know, marked, you know, wanting to ask questions, very, very deep questions, because they have become totally absorbed in the world. That's what I wanted. I thought, it's fair enough, it's great. I'm very grateful that I'm getting these lovely literate fan letters from people who were obviously readers to start with. What I really want to get is those people who think reading isn't fun, because it is fun. And once they learn that, it'll unlock such doors for them. That's I really feel that. And that's been, I think, honestly, that has been the great achievement of my career. That's the thing I'm most pleased about.
You mentioned writing it. You wrote those 8 books, the first ones, every 3 months, I believe. Write them in 3 months. You'd have a couple of weeks off, get your hair cut, do what you had to do, go back into it. And at a certain point, though, those books were being published.
Oh, yes. They started publishing before I had finished writing. So I had the amazing experience of receiving fan letters for the first part. See, I thought of the story, because I saw it as one big story that was just divided into 8 parts.
Yes, yes.
Before I had actually written the end, it was a great sort of, you know, a great experience. It really was. But it was very hard work, very hard work.
And has Rondo been as difficult then?
Rondo was quite different, because the Rondo books, there are 3 of those. Mm-hmm. The Key to Rondo is the first one. The Wizard of Rondo is the second. And the third is not going to be published till the end of this year. They are much fatter books. Yes. And I wrote them with nobody knew when I was writing them. I didn't tell my publisher I was writing them. I said I was having a year off, because I think I'd worked so hard on the Del Toro books. The timing was so rigorous, because I wanted them. This was my problem. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to come out on a regular basis.
And did you feel the same way about all 3 series of Del Toro, that they had to come out regularly?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I felt it was important for people to be able to read one and then within a fairly short time be able to read the next one, because I wanted to keep the momentum up and I didn't want them to have to retain too much. In that sense, I probably underestimated them because the readers are reading them over and over and over again. So actually they do retain. Mm. But nevertheless, that's how I felt. And the publisher was very happy to cooperate with that. Scholastic was great about it. Mm. So really, it was a great partnership, actually, between an author and a publisher, that Del Toro Quest, because they did put their, they really put their backs into marketing. And we had Mark McBride to do the covers, who was wonderful. And of course, they've subsequently suggested various other books like Tales of Del Toro or Secrets of Del Toro, which have spun off the main series. And I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it. But doing Rondo was a totally different experience. One, it had been waiting to be written for a very long time. And two, no one knew I was writing the first one, so there was nobody to say, well, if you can deliver by the 30th of April, we can publish it for October, or how's it going, or anything like that. I just didn't tell anyone. And so I actually just reveled in this world for a whole year. I had the most wonderful time.
Luxury.
It was a great, it was luxury, and it was a hugely pleasurable. And it was also, because the Rondo books have a lot of humour in them, and I enjoyed that very much as well. And so then I went sort of almost immediately into the second one. Isn't it terrible? See, I can't bear to leave.
That's right. So the luxury is sort of
I was very sad when Del Toro finished, and I didn't want to write anymore. But people were asking me and asking me, write some more, write some more, and they asked me that about Rowan too. But the fact is, stories don't go on forever. No. That's something that people have got to, authors too, and publishers. There comes a time when you have reached the circle that ends the story, and it's really better to just do that, to let the story end. Give it a good ending and let everybody
be happy.
Be happy and leave happy, because you keep on going, you'll trail off. We've all seen television series that do that.
Oh, yes, I know. And we don't, it gets worse. That's right. And you have to turn it off. And,
then you're sorry, and then it spoils the initial experience. As far as I'm concerned,
work
out your story.
It's an old, entertainment thing, isn't it?
Of course it is. Well, me too. But I always sorrow. Yes. I mean, you know, I've just sent off my last Rondo book. It's just gone off to the printer. So I'm officially in what my husband Bob calls post-novel tristesse. At present, because it's gone.
Well, the burning issue of publishing at the moment is parallel importing.
Yes.
How will it affect you?
Well, it will be disastrous if it happens to me. If it happens, at the moment, the recommendation is that we drop the idea of territorial copyright, and we just keep Australian publishers protected for, or and authors protected for 12 months, because in its wisdom, the committee has decided that most books make most of their money in 12 months, and that ought to satisfy everyone. What they don't understand, I mean, they've done some enormous sum, I imagine, and they've taken into account all the gardening books, all the books that came out for Christmas, all the books, etc. They've taken no count at all. The
of
fact
an author
that,
who has a series, the, for instance.
Well, yes. I mean, the successful books make most of their sales after 12 months. Of course they do. It's a terrible situation. I'm actually very, I mean, because you get school settings, you win the prizes, word of mouth starts to work. It is just simply not true at all that that the best or most successful books sell most of their, it's a very naive view, sell most in the first 12 months. Now, the fact is the system as it works at present is fantastic. The industry is thriving. Australian authors are known all over the world. We're exporting. We're getting terrific export money by exporting rights, not product. This is exactly what we're supposed to do, isn't it? We're supposed to be clever and export our knowledge.
And be well paid for it.
And be able to deal with the world without necessarily having to deal with material things. Now, if this happens, it's going to be disastrous. For example, Australian... If they get rid of our copyright, it means that my books, like Rowan of Rheim we were just talking about, now they're published in England and in the US. It means that England and the US will be able to send their copies over here and be sold next to my Australian publisher's copy, which means that I will receive negligible royalties for those. It means they will be full of American spellings and constructions, which upsets me no end.
Yeah, that seems to be the most upsetting thing to you, I think.
It's very upsetting to me.
Explain that, because I didn't realise the difference. So the Americans don't say, "She sighed." You can read a book, she said, sighing.
That's right. Yes, they have. There are various things. I mean, the spellings we all know about, the trash can issue, the sidewalk, the Americanisms, we know about that. They also have various grammatical constructions that we don't have, and they also object to things that we don't. For example, they don't like you saying, goodbye, Rowan laughed, or sighed, or chortled, whatever. They say there are only certain things called verbs of utterance, and that's what you have to do. So you get a lot of saids, particularly in my books, because I actually like to attribute, because I'm writing for children and sometimes quite young children, I like to say who's speaking most of the time. Anyway, I suppose the genuine problem too is with the industry, because I feel it'll be so bad for all the independent publishers if this happens. I have great hopes that actually, despite the reports, the government will see reason on this and won't do it, because there's nothing that I could see in the draft recommendations that indicate that there's any necessity, any likelihood books really are going to be cheaper. It seems to be just some ideological idea that it's a good thing to free everything up.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, yes, we have a territorial copyright here. So does England. So does the US. They're not going to let us send our books to them. They know better and they respect their culture more. And that's why I'm hoping very much that the combined efforts of the Australian Society of Authors and the individual authors, the publishers and the general public who will be writing to the Prime Minister and the concerned ministers and saying, look, don't destroy something that's working so well.
We are just about to go to the news, but can you have a rest? I mean, will you rest now? Or
I'm supposed to be resting now, but I gather what happens is I get really crabby.
So and your family are saying, go
a
right.
Loss, please go.
Right. And so do you have plans or ideas? Always ideas.
I actually do. I have two projects I'm thinking about. And it's
a
just
real book, or are we going to stay in children's?
Actually, I do have a real book partly written, yes, a mystery. But I must say it's so hard to make yourself move away from something that you know is appreciated, which is my children's writing is.
Emily Rodder, we look forward to whatever it is.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Emily Rodder, who you would also know as Jennifer Rowe. If you read those real adult books, I don't always. I quite like to stick to the kids. And it's been my pleasure to have Emily Rodder with us today.
Conversations with Lisa Forrest on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.